Good morning. You're very welcome to the show. Will we start with a bit of good news? Pfizer is investing $1 billion in a new Dublin biotech plant. They already employ 4,000 people here, making it one of the largest employers in the country. That's the front of the Business Post. And that is a huge, huge investment. I think they're saying here it's the biggest, one of the largest pharmaceutical investments in the history of the state. They also have on the bottom there, new mortgage limits put first-time buyers at risk as interest rates increase. And there's a lot across the papers about the new central bank mortgage rules. And they also have, as their kind of off-lead here, government hopes for pragmatic Sunak as an ex-British MP, she would say. You don't say, Sherlock. The Sunday Times, refugees from Ukraine denied roof over heads. Taoiseach insists country was prepared despite families being turned away from state provided accommodation. And you heard that developing situation there on the news. The Sunday Independent. If Shane Ross has nothing else to do, he has a great future as a book publicist. The front page is the Sunday Independent. Mary Lou's husband in threat to sue Shane Ross. Martin Lanigan claims chapter on family home in new biography of SF leader is defamatory and a breach of his financial privacy. The Irish Mail on Sunday, McEntee U-turn on release of Boxer's killer. And that is the story about, you know, the repatriation of the killer of 20-year-old Limerick man Kevin Sheehy. The killer was to be sent home to the UK, and Kevin Sheehy's mother was very upset about that. So it looks as if there's her petitions on that are being listened to. The Sun on Sunday has a story how the net is closing on the Kinahan cartel's main man in Ireland. And it does seem, whether it's media spin or just the stories being fed, it does seem as if the Irish police, in conjunction with police around the world, are really steadily dismantling the Kinahan cartel. The Sunday World, similar story. And they're saying that this man, Ross Browning, made millions dealing drugs to the feared Gucci gang. And the Mirror have that the Kinahans have put a $5 million bounty on Jerry the Monk Hutch, it is believed. OK, our panel this morning, Christina Finn is political correspondent with thejournal.ie. Gary Murphy is professor of politics at DCU School of Law. Professor Alan Barrett is an economist and director with the ESRI. And Louise Bayliss is campaign coordinator at Focus Ireland and a spokesperson for Spark, which is single parents acting for the rights of kids. Good morning, everybody. Gary, why don't you kick us off on that story on the front of the Sunday Independent?
Yeah, so in very big headlines, Mary Lou's husband in threat to sue Shane Ross. Listeners will know Shane Ross's Republican riddle has been published in the last few weeks, the subject of some controversy, particularly here within RTE, about whether an interview in the Claire Byrne show should go ahead or shouldn't go ahead under various caveats, which he wrote about extensively in last Sunday's Independent. I've read it. It's in one way, it's a rollicking good read. It reads very easily and quickly. You know, to my pain, there's no footnotes but not too many sources revealed. But it's it is a good read. And there's a very long chapter, 6, I think, called The Mansion in Cabra, which is full of speculation about the house that Mary Lou and her husband and their two children live in. I mean, he gives the address, and he's done a lot of digging, Shane Ross, about the house and about the buying of it. He charts her history in terms of where she lived. One might think it's prurient and an invasion of privacy.
Just to say that Shane Ross does say in that piece in the Sunday Inter that there is no allegation in the book of impropriety whatsoever.
And he writes in the book, very clearly, he writes something along the lines of, I don't have it here now with me, obviously, that Mary Lou is a person of the highest integrity and there's no suggestion of any impropriety or shenanigans or whatnot. But it's a very long, speculative chapter. He has defended it on the grounds that anyone in public life should have their dealings known. He goes as far to say that in terms of their register of interest, that all TDs and senators now have to submit, that bank accounts should even be mentioned, which seemed to be a step too far, and I think would be a step too far for most people who want to go into public life. And remember, we have, I think, a bit of a crisis of people wanting to stand for politics in the social media age, where, you know, everything is sort of is free rein. And now it appears that the husband of Mary Lou MacDonald, a man called Martin Lanigan, is going to sue. He says he's going to defend it to the hilt.
Well, yeah, so he's threatening to sue. He's demanding an apology, financial compensation and legal costs.
Yeah.
Or he will issue proceedings. So I think a letter was sent to Shane Ross.
A letter was sent. It was hand-delivered and it was stuck into the post. And there was a text message sent from the solicitors of Mr. Lanigan to Shane Ross. And he has said in the paper this morning that he will fully defend the action if it comes to a... court appearance and a libel trial. Now, as everybody knows, libel trials are notoriously difficult to call. You had the famous one of Albert Reynolds, who won a penny, I think, from the Sunday Times after an extremely long and expensive
and very bruising for him.
Very
I think.
Bruising, yeah. And very one might say even humiliating. And it's a huge risk for everybody involved. Now, and there's been a lot of talk this week in the papers about Sinn Féin representatives issuing legal letters, and Owen O'Brien came out to the Leinster House plinth during the week and said, well, if people stop basically telling, I'm not sure what the word he used, but...
Tell the truth about it. I don't know what he said, telling lies about
something along those lines, that there would be no issue. And
Christina, you were at that...
We had the Taoiseach come out to say that he views it as a very worrying development in Irish politics.
Okay, just before we go to Christina... Gary, as an academic, a political student, do you view it as a worrying development?
I do. I view anything that hinders political debate and political discourse as a potential worrying development. But also, people, of course, are entitled to their good name. So it's a tricky balance to be struck. But what you don't want is a raft of legal letter after legal letter after legal letter, which then makes people very worried about what they're going to say in studios like this or in public. Like, social media is a little bit of a cesspit, and anything goes, and anything shouldn't be allowed go, of course. And I think that's where the sort of difficulty lies. There was a good piece in yesterday's Irish Times charting the Sinn Féin sort of developments around who's got money from what, from various suits. So it's I do view it as a development. Ross, just to finish, Ross makes an interesting point, something close to my own heart. He says that we should be very wary of people who live in mansions. So he mentions Charlie Haughey, of course, I did a long biography of, and he mentions Michael Lowry in the book.
We should be very careful about putting Mary Lou MacDonald in the same category, her house in the same category of Lowry or...
Yeah, or Haughey, but the point is he's written a long 35-page chapter or so, maybe about 10,000 words on the house in the book.
Yeah, but again, he says himself, no suggestion of impropriety.
He writes it quite clearly,
Christina. I was at that press conference there with Owen O'Brien on the plinth in Leinster House, and there was extensive questioning from journalists about, I suppose, the policy within Sinn Féin, about whether they're helping to fund politicians. He was pretty categorical that it's up to the individual TD.
That there is
no policy, that it's not coming from Sinn Féin funds to fund any sort of legal action. And he did say, what Gary was mentioning there, that people and politicians, they have a right to defend their good name in court if they see fit. But I think, the headline like this today really does just throw fuel to the fire, I think, of the discussion around, perhaps the legal letters that people are saying they are getting from within Sinn Féin. But like, it has to be pointed out.
The legal letters people say they are getting.
That there has been journalists, media outlets, politicians, that's been reported in the Sunday Independent today. But also it points out that other political parties are not, shying away from this act also.
Yeah.
But
do you know what other politicians are?
Well, I suppose a lot of sort of controversy around, specifically towards, like, we're talking about property with, that politicians own. Specifically in this, we had Robert Troy. This is where
it's a completely different situation. Robert Troy did technically nothing wrong
exactly.
Except failing to. He failed to fill out his forms accurately,
correctly,
and he failed to have a property registered with the RTB.
But I think this is where the bigger debate has come around, property ownership within politicians. We've talked about spouses that are involved with the properties of politicians.
Would you agree with Gary that this is going to put people off politics if they feel that their personal, financial issues, houses they own with their spouses, are going to be fair game for public discussion?
No, I think the register of interests that's in place at the moment is a bit outdated, to be honest. And it's not a complicated form, I don't think so. You know, I was a bit flabbergasted when you heard a lot of politicians coming out to say that they were amending theirs and adding things, because there does seem to be confusion about what they are allowed put on or should put on. There is an issue about, you know, income they make from rent. Does that need to be put on? Like, I do think we live in a different world now. People want transparency around their political leaders, particularly when we're talking about, you know, I know we'll probably be touching on it later, housing crisis, okay, landlords and all okay the rest. But I think it does make the bigger question about, and Ona Brin did touch on this in the plinth, is defamation laws, legal letters, there's no doubt about it, have a chilling effect on media outlets across the board in Ireland.
By everyone, not just to do with political parties. Journalists do live in fear of a libel
exactly
action.
Exactly, and one libel action can take down...
Listen, I have to go to England now because we have a call that we have to take now. So the Tory leadership contest obviously ongoing and heating up today. We're joined now by Michael White, veteran commentator and former editor of The Guardian. Good morning, Michael.
Morning to you.
So, Michael, Rishi Sunak has confirmed he's running for the Tory leadership contest. He seems to be, in terms of numbers anyway, of MPs, he is the absolute front runner. What do you make of it all, Michael?
Well, like everybody else, I'm bewildered, exhausted, depressed. It's a complete shambles, and I'm sure it looks the same from Dublin to the Atlantic.
It looks like a bigger shambles to us than it does to you, I guarantee you, yeah.
You would be forgiven over there for laughing your socks off at us. You know, we've strutted high and mighty to you for centuries, and here we are looking like a banana republic. And oddly enough, Boris, where's he just come from? The Dominican Republic, the very idea of a banana republic. Never mind. That's where we are, and I don't know the outcome. I really don't know what's going to happen here.
That's it. Like, it is hard to say, isn't it? So this, are you familiar with this 3-hour meeting that Boris and Rishi had last night? Which, by all accounts, in the Mail certainly are portraying it as that Boris was setting out the terms to Rishi, like, and telling Rishi, so you need to be completely loyal. I'll be the PM, and you be the Chancellor of the Exchequer. Boris obviously feels he's in a position to dictate these terms to Rishi.
Well, Boris is a fantasy figure. He thinks he's Churchill, and he's not. For all his failings, Churchill was a formidable man and a great war leader, and Boris isn't. So I don't know where he's getting that stuff from. There's some dispute as to whether or not Boris is going to get enough support to get through. My hunch is that he will, but some of the other people saying, we won't believe your figures until we see their names, because we don't trust you, Boris. And that, of course, is why he was sacked just 3 long months ago. He can't tell the truth. He's a bit like Trump, you know, the idea of putting him in a court and swearing to tell the truth. Well, you can't imagine it.
So it's extraordinary. You're right. You point this out, that, like, this is a guy who wants to be the Prime Minister again, but nobody believes what he's even saying about the numbers he has to be Prime Minister. But you think he'll get over the 100, Michael, do you?
Well, I don't know. I hear Tory MPs saying he's the only one to unite the country. And I say, well, hang on a minute. He's never united the country. He doesn't. And now he even divides his own party. I mean, this is serious stuff.
I suppose he has a mandate, though, technically.
Oh, yeah, sort of. Yeah, but he does in terms of parliamentary mandate. But as in your country and ours, you sometimes change the Taoiseach between elections. It happens. We all know why. Half the MPs of my lifetime, they've all been changed. You think about them as you go through the list. Anthony Eden, Harold Macmillan, Callaghan, Major, etc., etc. So there's no big deal about changing the Prime Minister. The fact is he was kicked out. And I'll tell you what, the thing which is so introverted about this, that this weekend I've hardly heard any mention of what will the financial markets think on Monday when they discover that Boris might be Prime Minister again. I mean, I imagine they'll sell sterling.
They weren't impressed even at the mention of his name on Friday. I think the markets moved against sterling and the English debt, you know.
Well, the trouble is with the English is that they think when they voted for Brexit, and all this trouble stems from Brexit, you're not meant to say that on the British media anymore, but I can say it to you. It's all the great split over Brexit. Dare I say it's a bit like 1921 and the treaty on partition, which did dreadful things to your country. This, God knows where this will end. But the fact is that we think we're sovereign. We know we voted to be a sovereign, independent nation.
You took back control.
But the bond market doesn't take any notice of that nonsense. We need to borrow money. They'll charge us for the extra privilege. They'll charge her a lot more, and we can't afford it. So we're learning the limits of sovereignty, but some of them still haven't got it. It's embarrassing. It's also very, very expensive.
God, Michael, we caught you at a very low point in your relationship with your country, didn't we? Listen, you clearly think there's a chance that by tomorrow, or certainly by Friday, that Boris Johnson is the Prime Minister again. A chance, I'm saying. Well, is there any chance that his stint in purgatory in the Dominican Republic and Greece and elsewhere, cooling his heels, that the new Boris could be any different to the old Boris?
No, I mean, one thing we've learned in the last 5 years is when Boris says he's going to change, all his friends, many of whom have turned away from him in the Spectator and the Daily Telegraph, have finally turned against him. We do know one thing doesn't change is that Boris doesn't change. He can't.
Michael White, veteran commentator and former editor of The Guardian, thank you very much. You can't beat a veteran for a few home truths at times. What Michael was just saying there at the end, Alan, both you and Louise picked Tim Shipman, who tends to be very well informed on these things. The Sunday Times very much going with this line, Alan, that the tide is going out on Boris Johnson.
Yeah, it seems to be the case, all right. And I suppose there's a few big names have come out against him. While he did bag, as it were, Jacob Rees-Mogg, and I believe Priti Patel has come out in favour. Kemi Badenoch, Kemi Badenoch is somebody I'd never heard of until the most recent Tory race. But
we know she's on the right wing of the party.
Exactly. Of course, Lord Frost, whom we do know very, very well, again, has come out and has urged against the return of Boris Johnson. So it's still, it's hard to know, and as your previous speaker was just sort of saying, because there's this uncertainty of precisely how many MPs are backing Johnson, we don't know. There still seems to be this idea that if it does go to the membership, and I mean, I have to say, I was absolutely blown away by the idea that the membership were going to be given a role in this at all. Given what happened the last time, you would have thought the Tories would have engineered things in such a way that the membership would get nowhere near this.
Well, I think they're trying to, in that there will be huge pressure on one person to sit down tomorrow, won't there?
Indeed, but yeah. I mean, if the pressure's on that one person called Boris Johnson, I think that you can imagine what the chances of that is happening. So you could still be in a situation that it would be Sunak and Johnson going to the Tory faithful. There is polling out today. It was in the Mail, for example, that if you look across the country, Boris still seems to give the biggest bounce to the Tories. I mean, it's absolutely extraordinary, but I mean, I think collectively we've given up trying to understand this. We just have to sort of read it. But he still remains, it seems, the most compelling figure in British politics. And a lot of the discussion is...
I saw someone make the point that even when Boris Johnson was doing nothing in the last few days,
still all
eyes and all energy on him, even to see the potential of what he was going to do, that he just has that.
He just has it. He will still have support from the famous the Red Wall seat MP. I mean, the people who won seat who never won seats in Tory certain areas. So it's possible, but I think increasingly unlikely.
Louise, before I get your thoughts on this, just to let people know where it sits, according to Sky, Sunak has 126, Boris Johnson's at 57 and Penny Mordaunt's at 23. According to Guido Fox, who say that they have checked out all of these names, Sunak's on 139, Johnson on 75, where he's been stalled since around 70 since yesterday on Guido Fox, and Penny Mordaunt on 27. Now, Louise, you picked that piece as well, the Tim Shipman piece.
I did. I thought it was a fascinating read. And if anybody wants to buy a paper today, I would buy that paper just for that read. It's really insightful. But what really is shocking about the whole thing is Boris Johnson, as was said by Michael, was He was on a beach in the Dominican Republic while he was being paid from the taxpayers' money, 86,000, to be an MP.
I suppose he'll be on holidays, though, isn't he? He seems to be on holidays a lot.
He does seem to be on holidays a lot. And well, in fairness, not when Parliament is sitting, exactly. They have their breaks built in. And he was on it. Nobody seems to even question that now. If I didn't turn up on my job tomorrow, I would be questioned and I wouldn't get a pay and I wouldn't certainly be up in line for promotion. But also, I think while I was looking at it, when I was reading the article and they talked about the BAFTA award and all these dinners and them drinking their Tattinger champagne, making these decisions that are affecting real life people.
Yeah.
If anybody looked at ITV during the week and the report from North Shields about the absolute deprivation and poverty faced by people. There was a really fascinating report on Tuesday and Wednesday of last week done on North Shields, and the absolute devastation that has been. Now, always those regions in the north of England would always be quite poor.
Yeah.
But with
and
cost
Wales, like Channel 4 have been doing reports.
Yeah,
Wales,
exactly. And we know that they are also at the brush end of things. But when you see that and then you read.
But yet, the Red Wall believes in Boris. It's a Trump-style thing where the blue-collar and the low-paid seem to kind of think...
It seems to be he appeals to the mass exactly like Trump. He says the right language. He has that buffoonery about him. He has that charisma. And there's a vacuum there. But when you... But I did, just the idea of reading that article and the lifestyle they're leading and then putting that, equating that to a 65-year-old woman in North Shields getting up on the bus to go to work at 5 o'clock every morning and then saying she didn't have the electricity to put a slice of toast in the toaster. And to think that these people are making these decisions that has these real concrete effect on people. It's just such a divide. And I know we talk about the divide in Ireland, but thank God I don't think we're as bad as that yet.
Yeah. Gary?
I think the Red Wall is gone and it will crumble significantly simply because the promises of 2019 haven't been kept. Basically, I think, as Michael White said, who's been covering British politics a long, long time, it's a complete shambles.
Do you think is there going to need to be an election at some point, or will they manage to avoid that?
I think they'll manage to avoid it a little bit like here. People say, well, will there be an election here? But they're for the governing parties, there's nothing in an election except trauma and most certainly, I think, defeat, certainly for the Tories. I mean, if you look at Labour, it's 55% in the polls, 36 points ahead, more than they actually got in 2019. I remember sitting in an RT studio on the night of the British general election, people talking about perpetual Tory government. And, we know how things change in politics. I mean, there seems to me a sort of lack of seriousness around Tory politics in particular. I mean, Boris Johnson, one could argue, is not really a serious person. Like, he's writing a book about Shakespeare. He reminds me of Banquo's ghost, and he keeps popping up. But he's getting someone else to write it for him, and his name will appear in the cover. Liz Truss, I mean, had this sort of fantasy idea of politics. Britannia Unchained, a book she wrote with Kwasi Kwarteng and Dominic Raab and somebody else whose name I can't remember now, about a decade ago, saying if we could only get rid of the EU and the shackles, everything would be great.
And if English and workers would get up
what did she call them? The laziest idlers in the EU or in Europe. And then this fantasy idea that you, and just the optics of it, getting rid of bonuses for bankers. Like, who here really thinks that bankers need to be looked after better? Very few, I would imagine. 5% off the top rate of, or getting rid of the 45% cut without any thought of the consequences of this. If she had just do the classic thing, campaign in Portrait Govern in prose, if she didn't have a mini budget and had just sat on things and kept things going, she would still be in power.
Well,
now,
as she said herself, she admits she could have prepared the ground a bit better. when the great
but I think the ground has shifted so substantially. Yeah. So I think, there is a little thing about political parties being in power too long. The Tories have been there now since 2010 in one guise or another, and I think the British public will have had enough of them.
Come here, if only they would listen to us, and this is the common sense that's being talked here. We're like the Skibbereen Eagle.
I think it's like we're the onlookers looking in. It's very hard for us as outsiders to try and decipher what exactly is going on within the Tory party. I think when you see the likes, as what Louise was saying, Boris Johnson, the buffoonery of him and him somehow appealing to the people that he in no way is connected to at all in terms of his background and privilege, but somehow seems to appeal to them somewhat like Trump. I thought the Tim Shipman piece again was great, but the artwork particularly kind of spoke to exactly what it was, saying that after seeing Truss dispatched like a hunted fox, her predecessor sprang from a sun lounger, and it has a great cartoon character of him springing off the beach thinking that he can return to number 10. And it just even that text message that was being reported that he sent, like, I'm coming back, I'm back in business. Like, it just,
and Nadine Dorry is saying the boss is back. I mean,
it's just, but I think if they do.
But you know what? Is there one kind of thing that we're saying here is that these are not serious people and everything, but do the Boris Johnsons and the Trumps of the world understand modern politics and modern
and
democracy
media,
better than most?
They seem to be operating within a vacuum of themselves in terms of focusing more so on their party, even though it's probably going to be split by the looks of it if it goes down a certain route, without actually thinking of the consequences of all this.
It's like a game. It's like a big game to them, to many of them. It's like like, you know, the PPE.
You used to say show business for
a little bit, and, you know, the sort of Oxford, you know, politics, philosophy, and economics, that degree where all politicians seem to do, and you know, the Bullingdon Club, and, you know, the debating societies.
Did you debate?
A little bit. I remember debating with you.
Remember those types.
I'm sad, and I do.
Yeah, did we ever think those English guys we used to debate against, who were all kind of semi-clowns, like, would end up running the country?
I know.
Alan, you wanted to come in there.
Well, just, I mean, to add to the discussion, I mean, the UK does have profound problems. And again, what is really sort of troubling about this is that, you know, the circus around the politics does seem to deflect attention. But just to take two of their chronic problems, they have one of the most unequal societies in the world. OK, now, there's various ways of looking
in
at
the
that.
World.
Yeah. I mean, if you could think about it in terms of, you know, income distribution. But I think one of the things that always comes up, and we touched on it earlier, is the regional inequalities in the United Kingdom. And it's as if on occasions, because London is such an engine of growth, that people can look at London and think, oh, the UK is a really fine performing economy. Okay, it actually has much greater difficulties. So inequality is a huge problem. Its productivity performance now over 20, 30 years has been really, really problematic. Brexit has been, obviously, it's been a huge problem for two reasons. One is because economically it has done tremendous damage. But there's this collective denial, and this comes up in the papers too as well today. So it's not just that Brexit is an economic problem. It's almost like it's a problem, but nobody's allowed to discuss it as a problem. Nobody's allowed to admit this. But even, like, you know, the ESRI had a paper out on this during the week, Martina Lawless, looking at how the extent to which trade, you know, to the UK has diminished as a result of Brexit. But yet you even have sort of people like Labour. It's almost, you know, they're not willing to say it either. It's all about, now let's make a success of Brexit. We have this.
Don't talk it down.
Yeah. Mm. And so there's so many collective difficulties. There's a press that seems to be, again, boosterish, you know what I mean? Always wanting to turn. And again, you know, when Liz Truss arrived, they were all sort of so positive. It was just this, again, strange thing. So
flat economics, Alan. Is Brexit a disaster? On the numbers? We'd like to think it is, but is it really?
No, absolutely. And I mean, one of the things where there's a sort of a lot of discussion, you know, is almost been suppressed in the UK, it was very noteworthy over the last few weeks, because the Liz Truss government had bypassed agencies like the Office of Budget Responsibility in the United Kingdom. Certain research institutes, Institute for Fiscal Studies, the National Institute for Economic and Social Research, had a sort of plugged the gap. And I think where Truss thought she could sort of bypass these organisations, these organisations were pointing out exactly where the problems were and the scale of the difficulties. And
so does that suggest that for any, you know, there's been this conversation about that, really anyone who says we are going to disrupt traditional economics and the way things were done, we're going to spend, we're going to do this, that and the other. I suppose people are looking at Italy now and starting to worry about their precariousness. Does this mean you can't break the old-fashioned rules of the markets and
well, you can't, but I mean, just to answer that in a more fundamental way, I mean, the Truss idea coming from the Institute for Economic Affairs and the old sort of Thatcherite notions of trickle down, I don't think there's a serious economist on the planet who actually buys into that anymore. I mean, they were able to dig out a few people in the same way that very, very few serious economists were pro-Brexit. But really, that entire ideology was discredited so long ago. Nobody, it's serious, I can put it like that, thinks that by giving tax cuts to the very wealthy, that the trickle down, that this spawns innovation in such a way. Modern sort of growth theory is now all about investing in things like skills, infrastructure, good institutions. You know, there's a whole range of things. We know how economies grow. And back to people like my colleagues in the National Institute for Economic and Social Research in the United Kingdom, they have set up a productivity commission. commission, okay, to investigate what does the UK need to do. So there's lots of informed, intelligent discussion going on. The problem is it just doesn't seem to be percolating into the Tory party, who just, you know, and government at that level, who really just seem to have lost it. And back to Gary's point, I mean, I think there's almost like a natural life cycle for political parties. Fianna Fáil had this in Ireland from time to time, that after very long periods in government, I don't know if it's a laziness or what happens, but it's almost like, you know, eventually there's a need to move on.
The sort of feel of 2011 in Ireland, where the Fianna Fáil Green government completely collapsed in farce, really, when Brian Cowan tried to basically get rid of six ministers and replace them with six others. The Greens wouldn't live with it. Then John Gormley said we were neither in nor out, taking the public for fools, really, as if they wouldn't understand the sort of intricacies of politics here. And I think there's a similar thing happening in Britain, that the people, once the next election comes around, have their mind made up to dump the Tories. The great irony, to go back to Alan's point, of course, is that their great belief in the market as the sort of solver of everything has really come back to bite them, come back to bite Liz Truss, where the market reacted in ways that she simply didn't either expect or, I think, more fundamentally understand.
Well, yeah, everyone else seemed to expect and understand it.
That was my point about serious politicians.
Rishi, yeah. So listen, I suppose if they are all listening on the edge of their seats to hear what we think, which they are, we could say to them that if this is analogous to that collapse, you can come back from it and things can be okay again. So they needn't think it's forever. Okay, lest we be accused of dwelling too gleefully on our neighbours' problems, can I assure everybody that for the second half of the panel, we will dwell firmly on our own problems, beginning, and you've all picked this, but maybe, Christina, you might set us up on this, which is the front of the Sunday Times, and this is the ongoing story about refugees and the accommodation of them.
Yeah, well, we saw there the other day that Roderick O'Gorman had come out to say that the City West complex had reached capacity, that they were no longer accepting new entries from arrivals from Ukraine and other countries, and basically putting the government in a very sticky position in terms of...
Have you any idea where this is going? Do they have any idea where it goes from here?
I don't think they have the answers as of yet. I think they have run out of capacity. They are, as they said, working as much as they can to find it. The difficulty is that it just doesn't seem to be there. The Taoiseach was at the Fianna Fáil President's Dinner last night, which I was at, and he was speaking to the media before it, defending the government's position, saying that he believed they had acted extremely fast in their response, I suppose, saying that nobody could have predicted the numbers that were going to arrive. It was pointed out to him that actually there was plenty of predictions of the numbers, a lot bigger perhaps than we've even seen coming
in. Did we even believe them, I wonder, in reality?
Yeah, they were being plucked out from
200,000, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Wasn't that the figure?
So I suppose people were questioning, you know, if that was one prediction, could we not have put preparations in place? But we have 33 people, I think it was yesterday, that were turned away, didn't have any accommodation.
Yeah, and 10 more we're hearing on the news.
The Capuchin Centre was taking in, looking after a few of them. And the Taoiseach said last night that a number of them had decided to return to Dublin Airport. Interestingly, he said that the government is facing perhaps one scenario where they have refugees from Ukraine that are staying in hotels at the moment, and they've come in and they've stayed there for a long period of time. They've made friends, they're like a community, their schools might be going to their children might be going to a local school, and a house perhaps has come up, or a pledged house that someone can move on to. He's saying they're finding difficulties moving some of the Ukrainian refugees out of the hotel accommodation into those specific new accommodations.
Because they don't want to uproot.
Because they don't want to uproot. They've been through, I suppose, a horrific time as it is. They've built a support system around them. So a very delicate situation, I think, as the Taoiseach was trying to spell out, in terms of how to free flow, I suppose, some of the accommodation that is
Louise,
coming online.
Like, this is such a tricky situation, isn't it?
It's a terrible situation, and it's, you know, normally I would be quite have opinions on what the government should or shouldn't do. And in this case, I just can't see a solution. I don't know what the solution is, and I genuinely feel so sorry. But what I did notice over the weekend on trending on Twitter was Ireland is full, which is just such a horrible, nasty narrative that if the government doesn't step in and show transparency, and there is this idea that
the government has, in fairness, been saying something similar themselves, in that they've told the ambassador to Ukraine that, look, you know, we'll do what we can, but we can't promise.
Yeah, and absolutely. Yeah. And there is a there's a story on page 3 in the Sunday Times again this week, and it talks about, from the point of view of a refugee, actually in Ukraine at the moment. And I think it gives huge insight, because we're looking at it as a problem and how we deal with it. And then from the human point of view, this woman is there. She's saying she's there with her two sons. They're listening to the bombs screeching overhead every night. She's living on terror. She was really living for it to come over here on November 3rd or November 4th. She had a flight booked. And now the idea that she would be going into on the streets, possibly, if this situation gets much worse, is really frightening. So I think there's this huge humanitarian crisis. And while we're hearing about the 33 men that were turned away yesterday and the 10 men today, I know, because I work in homelessness accommodation, that at the moment there are an awful lot of families and people who are not accessing emergency accommodation through the Dublin Region Homeless Executive at the moment.
There's no bed for the night.
And they literally are told, go back to where you came from. There is no bed tonight. So we know that the emergency accommodation is running out for, you know, for Irish citizens too. And that's not to pitch one against the other, because they both have absolutely humane rights to be here, and we have a responsibility. Okay. But, I mean, and then as we look at the solutions that came up, we did all think it was short term. I mean, they offered student accommodation, not realise, you know, what was going to be the outcome in September when the students had to go back and families had to be removed again. It's
and there's
horrible
talk already
situation.
Of hotels needed again in March, April. Alan, you picked this as well.
I mean, so it's one of those sort of circumstances. I mean, normally, I think Louise kind of touched on this, where there's a problem, there's a desire to blame and to find fault and to sort of say, you know, the government should be doing something about this, whatever. But like genuinely, and again, I've listened to a number of commentators over the last day to say, well, what is the solution? And I haven't really heard anybody say it. And I mean, I've little doubt. I know some of the people in the relevant department who are working on this. I think the minister himself, these are all like very humane people who I know will be doing their absolute best to ensure that space is found for people. But very, very few countries, I think, could deal with a situation where you have, you know, the influx, the size of the influx.
We hear about countries in Eastern Europe that are taking like hundreds of thousands. Well, I don't know what they're doing.
The next issue might be, I mean, when the tents were put up in Gormanstown, I mean, the view was, well, this can only be temporary. It would be inhumane to keep people in such circumstances. And again, I think collectively we'd agree. But I suppose the question then arises at a certain point. Do you just start like lowering the ambition in terms of the quality of the housing that can be provided for people? Because at a certain point, anything is better than people being on the streets. So I don't know if that's, and I mean, let me put it like this.
Well,
if
you that can't is, you can't say no, we're not taking anymore.
Absolutely, we
you
can't.
We're not allowed to do that, and morally, I think people might have issues with it.
Exactly.
But on the other hand, if they are going to come.
Well, I think that, you know, at a certain point, the issue comes up that, you know, you want to do the absolute best that you can. And I'm not entirely sure what that is, but it could be the case that sort of collectively we'll just have to sort of be understanding of the circumstances in which government is actually operating. And if the accommodation isn't what we would consider in a sense ideal, you know, so be it.
One of the things that is happening on Monday is the cabinet subcommittee is meeting. So the coalition leaders and a number of departments are going to come together. And the Taoiseach said last night to bring forward, I think, just ideas on basically everyone put their heads together about how we might make some dent.
But it seems to be back to the things we talked about 6 months ago, vacant buildings, which a lot of them didn't seem to come through.
And
in
this
the
400
end.
Euro
modular housing, which we didn't seem to start at the time.
Yeah, the 400 euro payment that people get if they take in Ukrainian refugees, that's on the table for discussion for increasing, because obviously the cost of living crisis is the whole other flip side of an argument that we have on a daily basis. Energy costs, you know, energy bills coming into people, is the incentive there for somebody to open their door to allow a family come in if they're struggling themselves to pay the bills? So that's something that's going to be looked at on Monday, but it'll be interesting to see what sort of solutions do come to the table, I think, on Monday, because I do think the message that the government is getting out and you know, is saying, you know, they're struggling severely to get to
there are still stories
people.
Of people who stated that they would take people in and having Garda vetted and having then subsequently got the calls.
Like, yeah, and we're, look, as every show when they discuss this gets the text and people saying I've offered a room but I haven't been taken.
And I think that needs to be really interrogated tomorrow at the subcommittee meeting.
No, but look, again, this has been interrogated before. There's been whole discussions about is it the county council saying, you know, it's the blockage isn't at their end and whatever. Gary, do you worry the political temperature, not in Ireland but around the place, I mean UK and Europe and everything, it's alarming in lots of places, right? When you hear things like as a historian, Ireland is full, trending on Twitter and stuff like that, is there a potential here to get into nasty territory?
Yes, it's the short answer to that. There certainly is the potential, but the Irish political system has been you know, we've democracy for over 100 years. It was born in extreme violence and in extreme complicated situation, and it has flourished for the most part, notwithstanding those who argue Ireland is a failed state, which I think all the data would show that Ireland is clearly not a failed state. A very
well, it depends on who you are. It's failing for some people.
Well, it is failing for some people, but that's different to a failed state. There's a very good piece by John Walsh on this on the Business Post, why Sinn Féin's narrative of an extreme right-wing government in Ireland does not stand up to scrutiny. He talks about the progressive nature of the tax system. What I would say is, anytime you've had right-wing so-called candidates, even at European elections, local elections, the results have been negligible. The party system has been robust, and even if the collapse of Fianna Fáil, as you alluded to earlier, Brendan, they're back in there. The Taoiseach is a Fianna Fáil member. I would suggest that the political temperature here does have the capability to go right, but probably not, because I think the people are more humane than that. And it goes back to Louise's point about could we have a quota for potentially, and most people think that would be morally wrong.
Given this debate, I suppose, around the crisis that the government is facing, I spoke to a number of government sources, senior ones, that have raised concerns that they think that immigration is the next battleground for Ireland. They said it hasn't necessarily reached here like it has with other European countries, but given, I suppose, the pressures that we're under, there's a real risk of having a split, you know, a split down the middle, those sort of narratives, those sort of hashtags.
Just very quick, I mean, we've been hearing that for an awfully long time, but I also think one of the things that characterises Ireland and Irish people is that a huge proportion of us were emigrants at one stage.
Which makes
and there isn't
a
family in Ireland that doesn't have an emigrant somewhere.
Yeah.
And I always thought it was one of the things that kind of conditioned our attitude a little bit.
Yeah, but you know what? I think we're seeing in the UK as well that there can be a pull up the ladder kind of attitude as well sometimes. But anyway, be that as it may, let's hope it's not the next battleground. The current battleground is still housing. And there's obviously a lot in the papers today about the central bank rules and various other aspects of it. But Alan, you picked a story by Michael Brennan in the Business Post. Generation rent, does it finally have the politicians on its side? Do you think, are they finally taking this seriously or more seriously than they were?
I think what struck me here, what's very interesting about the piece, it's around the sort of shifting power blocks, okay? And I suppose historically, if you look in a country, landlords, you would have sort of said, well, they're a powerful group of people because by definition they have property, and, you know, at the time of Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil were, so, you know, the centre-right parties were the dominant. There might have been a feeling that in any sort of battle between renters and landlords at a political level, the landlords were going to win.
The establishment
and, you know, and that not just in terms of politics, but possibly through the judiciary and elsewhere, that the deck was sort of stacked in a particular direction. But what Michael Brennan does in his piece is start looking at the numbers who are now renters across different age groups. And I think there's one of these things that for a long time in Ireland, they would have had a group of renters who had an expectation that they were going to be owners before too long. So there was a different,
identify as
renters.
Even if you thought
your landlord was a horrible person or something like that, you had this sort of feeling, well, I only have to deal with this person for another, sort of. But what's shifting over time is this notion that you have a growing block of renters. While they're not sort of coalescing together necessarily, just as a block, they possibly have more power. And of course, Sinn Féin in particular and other parties on the left are now tapping into this. So the thesis is really that there's a sort of a shifting political narrative. And you would have thought it for years, a bit like employers and workers in some ways, that these things move over time.
Okay. Christina, do you feel that?
I've long said that I find it very difficult to understand the government's position on how they're dealing with renters for years. I don't think they have taken on board the difficulties, taken it seriously, put in the measures in place that perhaps need to help people. Just for full declaration, I am a renter, so yeah. I'm going to be full okay, and open
so
and honest
so
about it.
So, for example, do you think that the idea of being able to borrow a little bit more, so you've more of a chance of getting mm-hmm. into a mortgage where you could be paying less than you are in rent, was that a good development this week in the Central Bank?
Yeah, I think it's a bit, I'm a bit torn on it. I was at the press conference at the Central Bank with the Governor and, you know, I had specifically asked on rental issues because, as you said, I think it's not just that small group of people now, and I think the political parties are cottoning onto it because even if it's not their voter base, I think they fast realised that their voter base is children cannot get houses mm. and that is having a knock-on impact in their support. So when I was at that press conference this week, I thought it was interesting that the Governor of Central Bank mentioned in a speech about renters' track record for payment should be considered in someone's mortgage application, because for a long time people have said...
Is it not? No.
For a long time people have said that it is, that it isn't, that it's a bit of an ad hoc situation. So when I asked him, he said any prudent lender that is assessing a mortgage application should take into consideration someone mortgage repayments. But the fact is
that
someone
would be helpful.
That definitely would be helpful. But the fact is that the rules still don't necessarily tie in with that, because you could be paying a hell of a lot more in your rental payment than you would be in a mortgage. So you're just not going to get that same level. He did also mention that, look, the 4 times your income isn't a target, you know, like. But at the same time, you know, people are chasing the housing prices. It, like, at the same time, where something needs to be done to tackle the housing prices issue. It's not just about putting money back in people's pockets, because it just ends up being a constant chase to get to that higher price.
Louise, you want to come in briefly?
Yeah,
before I
do. I think there's a huge issue with the housing market altogether, but it's out of sync. So there's always been 3 parts of the housing market: was the private rental market, social housing, and then the purchase market. And the social housing has stopped for 10 years, and social housing has been pushed into the private rental market. So there's now 60,000 people on HAP in the private rental market that should not traditionally be there. That has a result of inflating private rental property, mm-hmm. and that's why people like Christina is paying over the odds rent. You can't start fixing one end of it without realising the 3 of them are a delicate balanced ecosystem, and what's happened is we're tinkering
and the government,
at the edges.
In fairness, I think they seem to be putting it more of a stress on the tenant in situ
situation, which is really positive, and they will get that. But what we do need to do is really, you know, I think people didn't realise the importance of social housing in their own life if they weren't in that zone of social housing. But we do. It's impacting on everything. We need to lift those 60,000 HAP tenants out of the private rental market and get some type of balance back into the market.
And there's an interesting piece I think Dave Quinn has.
I was just about to mention that. Fine Gael has lost its purpose, but self-defeating eviction ban. So he has a different view that Fine Gael and the government has interfered in the market too much, and that they've lost their way and they need to go into opposition to rediscover their centre-right instincts. But like, I remember Simon Coveney in 2017 telling us all homelessness would be gone by the end of that year. We had famously Rebuilding Ireland.
Families out of hotels.
Yeah, now Fine Gael have another plan for when Leo Varadkar takes over on December the 15th, which again I think mostly is to do with tax cuts or tax breaks
they're
for developers
gearing,
and
they're
the
definitely
like.
Gearing up for some sort of move beyond the Housing for All policy. Mm. Even Micheál Martin said that last night in a speech, that they're willing to go beyond the policy. So there definitely seems to be two of the three bidding each other up now because it's going to be the most important issue
come the general election by far, even more so than health, which has nearly always been number one for the past 5 or 6 elections. This is housing is clearly going to be, and not just because of the homeless situation, but because, as Christina said, those people like me in their 50s, their children will be living with them forever or for a significant time at least.
O'Connell Street, Christina, we saw that extraordinary prime time during the week, which has certainly kicked off a conversation, I think. You picked out Liam Collins has a piece in the Sunday
about it. He has a really interesting piece sort of discussing the history of O'Connell Street and restoring it to maybe its former glory. And just one paragraph kind of jumped out at me about the glory days of the Gresham Hotel and how, you know, the Prince of Monaco stayed there and Muhammad Ali, and it was just, you know, the height of elegance, and so was the street.
And I'm sure
the time.
It still is.
Of course. It's a beautiful hotel and it's probably one of the best kept kept places, I would say, on O'Connell Street at the moment, because in and around it, it's just so depressing, I think, to see the street and what's happened to it, because it actually is such a great thoroughfare. It has, you know, trees alongside it. It could have so much potential. But I think this week it's definitely highlighted the serious lack of investment. And Niall O'Connor, one of my colleagues in the Journal, spoke to a former Garda Sergeant who was tasked with looking at major events in and around Dublin City Centre. And he was critical of the Operation Citizen model, I suppose, that the government rolled out last year about, you know, putting more guards on the street, saying that basically it was just under-resourced and that it's actually taking Gardaí from other sections around, that is stretching their resources. So that there hasn't been proper investment, that there
but
needs
then
to be...
people would say that there isn't enough policing on O'Connell Street. I mean,
like
the stuff that's
I would travel
there,
down it, like, it would be on my way from my bus route, so I kind of see it all the time when I'm having a look to see. Now, I definitely have seen new businesses pop up there in recent months, which I think are great, but they're kind of coffee shops there for the commuters and things like that. I know a lot of people would be critical of, I think Liam Collins mentions perhaps one of the downfalls was having so many fast food joints, you know, set up there in the 1970s, that maybe that wasn't sort of the best, you know, makeup to have on such an area.
But they're not the cause of the issue. I wonder as well, you see, Louise, I know there are socioeconomic issues here that you would probably like to get into, but just without going right into that, because we don't have the time either. Did the lockdowns kind of advance the disintegration of a lot of town and city centres?
Absolutely.
Like, they never came back, did they?
Absolutely. I think that's a really valid point. And I think there were people who didn't get help with drug addictions, didn't get into the rehabs, didn't get into that. They all went, they all migrated together into the city centres. Yeah.
And it became their space.
It became their space. I agree with Christina, because I was I haven't been in O'Connell Street in a long time. And I don't know why, but I wasn't. But I was in it a couple of Saturdays ago, and I just got an awful feeling. And that is not to condemn the people on the streets who are living there. But there's obviously a breakdown in supports for people. Mm. And I won't go into the socioeconomic, because I could be here all day.
Not, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and we understand that. But there is definitely, there is a sense of, I don't want to say it because it sounds like I'm trying to, you know, treat people like they're animals. But, you know, when animals went into streets in China, when the lockdown happened in China, and that's not what I'm comparing about. I'm not comparing people. Yeah. But it is like people migrated into the city and the supports aren't there and something needs to be done.
Yeah. Gary, what do you think?
Well, there are two things. One is that it certainly, I read somewhere that when tourists are dropped off on O'Connell Street, they get a tremendous shock that this main thoroughfare has sunk to a sort of 18th century or 19th century Dickensian look. And certainly as a parent of people who go out into the city centre, you don't want them to go anywhere near O'Connell Street. So it's a kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy of despair, I think, around the street. I would suggest that far more aggressive policing, assertive policing, I mean more visibility, would be the start. Simply on the grounds of, if people feel it's unsafe walking through the main city of the state, one might argue, well, that's a very bad reflection on everybody. And not just, and people are passing the buck. Council, is it the council's business? Is it the government's business? I mean, I do think that some sort of task force is essential, bringing in all stakeholders, or else it's going to you know, sink further into
Feel like there might be a bit of momentum there.
Yeah, and it's not just about making it nice for tourists. Like, we do, as you said, the social. Yeah. We can't turn our back on the issues like the injection centre. Well, that's
exactly.
Shining.
I was going to say the injection centres. Unless we get an injection centre,
it's serious debate and serious get that over the line and tackle those issues, because it's not just about tourists, it's our own city.
Okay,
I agree
completely. Listen, thank you all very much. We could have gone on and on there, I feel. Christina Finn, Gary Murphy, Professor Alan Barrett and Louise Bayliss.